I wanted to say another thing about my the history that I've just given you about the origin of the triple quadruple. Having the responsibility for writing this up, the history of MSMS, tandem MSMS, for the Encyclopedia of Mass Spectrometry, I took very seriously. And I knew there were a lot of versions of the story out there, and there were a lot of players involved, and I wanted to make sure that I wasn't writing something that they would find controversial. Mm-hmm. And so when I wrote the draft of this, I sent it to Rick, I sent it to Jim Morrison, I sent it to Gene Futrell, to Graham Cooks, all for their input on it. And I got some input back, and I made some changes and so on, and what I'm telling you is exactly what I got from them. So the major players who were part of this have all signed on to this. This is the story. It was just last year somebody published an erroneous history. I think it came out in American Lab or something, and I wrote the editor, Jim Stout, and I with a correction, and he promised to publish it and didn't. So it's still there. I was and I think a lot of people probably think that we did very well with the patent on the triple quadrupole, and Research Corporation did do very well. The arrangement that we had, Michigan State gave 15% of the patent proceeds to the inventors. It's now much higher in at most universities, but that's what it was there at the time. but a Research Corporation took half.
Oh, wow.
So this is now 15% of the half that goes back to Michigan State, right? and there were three inventors, because of course we included Jim Morrison as an inventor on the patent. And so so it ended up that each of us got $50 for each instrument that was sold, okay, which is nice. I'm not saying that I feel at all slighted by this. It's just that the perception that anybody got rich over this, any of the inventors got rich over this as well. And at that time, Finnegan adopted it right away, and SciEx. Those are the two companies that came out with it right away first. There was a European company that began to do it also, but they decided they didn't really need to have the patent. They just did it. And there wasn't enough money in the instrument business those days. I mean, if a company sold 100 mass spectrometers of a particular model in a year, that was good.
Right.
That was really good. So Hewlett-Packard looked into it, but they don't like using other people's patents. And so they didn't come out with a triple quadrupole until the patent expired.
Oh, wow.
Now, $50 an instrument would be wonderful because they're selling like hotcakes. It is still the most, still the version of mass spectrometer most widely sold. It has the highest volume still. And the reason is, even though it's limited in terms of the data production rate, it is the most sensitive and the most selective and the best for quantitative analysis of all the tandem versions that are out there. And so, and when electrospray ionization came along, it just went crazy.
Can you talk about that transition, you know, obviously happening from triple quadrupole to, you know, moving into electrospray? Obviously that was a big deal starting in the 80s in the mass spec community. You know, what was that transition like for you moving toward that path of research?
Well, I thought electrospray ionization was interesting. I wasn't particularly interested in it, and other people were developing it. I wasn't interested in big molecules. I'm still kind of pretty much a physical chemist. I took on a minor in physical chemistry and physics in graduate school, and as I told you, when I told her what I wanted to work on, it was something fundamental. So I wasn't all that interested in it, but I was watching it just because I thought it was an interesting process. I was at an ASMS workshop in Florida, and electrospray was one of the main topics coming up there, and some people were talking about what was going on, and how everything was all just, you know, it was because there was only 10 microseconds or 100 microseconds, and and the solution was evaporating so rapidly and so on. And I raised my hand and I said, but surely all the charges on the surface of the drop. Oh no, that's absolutely impossible. It's way too dynamic a situation and so on. And I went home and I said, okay, there's something needs to be done here. Okay, because now this goes back to electrochemistry, and this is part of my philosophy. Nothing is wasted. Because here I am, I've abandoned electrochemistry in a way that it's still here. And I knew about mercury drops and charge. I had worked in rapid electrode kinetics. I knew that the double layer formed in fractions of a microsecond. I mean, 10 microseconds was an acre of time to me in terms of where the charge was going to go. This was no problem. Then what happened was, so I sort of was storing that. Something here is unusual. Then a student of mine, Colleen Zememarash, and you'll have to look at my data to get the spelling on that. But he was really interested in inorganic chemistry, and he decided that he wanted to use electrospray to study the ratio of complex to uncomplex metal ions in a complex mixture. Interesting, and I like equilibrium stuff, so that appealed to me, and we were looking at it. Two things were going on. One was, in order to get any spectrum, you had to use sort of like millimolar concentrations, which are huge for electrospray, just out of sight. And the other is the fraction of complex mass versus uncomplex mass, and he was using silver ions and crown complexes, was totally wacky. I mean, completely upside down, orders of magnitude, just completely wrong. So, I thought that there was some huge selectivity process going on in the creation of the electrospirit ions, and that was why we were getting what we were doing. I think that interpretation of the data is wrong. Now, I think that the reason we were seeing so many silver ions is that the complexes were getting fragmented back into silver ion in the collision process. But nevertheless, that's what I thought, and that's what got me into it. And I started to think about what selective process would be going on. Well, if all the charge is at the surface of the drop, excess charge. Okay, there's lots of charge in there, but the excess charge is at the surface of the droplet, and that has to be. This is going back now to taking electricity and magnetism, right, in graduate school. That was rule number one. You got a conductor, the excess charge is at the surface, period. And I knew from polarography and studies with the double layer and so on exactly how that was going to get set up. So I thought, well, if all the excess charge is at the surface, then and th- the ions that are formed out of the excess charge, they're going to be coming from the surface. So probably the things that are at the surface preferentially are going to be preferentially ionized. So let's think about surface activity. So if we've got a combination of surface activity and the capability of accepting the excess charge, in other words, proton affinity, then those are the things that are going to be preferentially ionized. And now at this point, I didn't have any data to work with this. We didn't have an electrospray ionization setup. I talked to Gary, Georgia. Who did some early work on electrospray in Graham's lab. It'll come to me. about building one, and he said it's pretty simple. But meantime, I got a hold of some of Paul Cabarly's data and thought, well, I can work this up. He's already done the experiment that I need to do. And so I took Paul's data and tried to get a hold of the raw data, but I couldn't. I had to read it off his graphs. and processed it came up with the idea that the surface activity was like a partition process, that molecules would partition to the surface according to their surface activity degree. And so I could treat that as an equilibrium. So I had a charge balance equation and I had a mass balance equation for the analyte and also for just the charged solvent. And worked that out and fit it to his data. And that was not too bad because it was just quadratic, but then when you put in an extra analyte, it becomes cubic. Well, okay, so I solved the cubic equation and fit his data. And I did it with just one equilibrium constant for the partition coefficient for each of the analytes. And of course, he had done this with tetraalkyl ammonium salts, and the one with the longer chain had the higher surface activity and had the higher response, and it just started to fit beautifully. And so I wrote that up, and I did that all by myself. I didn't have any graduate student on it at all. Hours and hours and hours of developing this, and so I wrote that paper up. Again, I got one nice review, sort of, well, this is interesting. One absolutely scathing, you don't know what you're talking about. You should start at the beginning and work up from fundamentals. I presented the paper at ASMS, and the entire discussion period was taken up by somebody in the audience ranting that I hadn't taken into account all that was going on there, and I really didn't know what I was talking about, and I should just stick to my guns and leave well enough alone. I presented this even earlier at Graham Cook's award symposium at ACS when he got the analytical award. And Fred McLafferty, who was there, just said, Chris, I don't know where you're coming from. That's just not the way it works. So again, but people saw the practical application of it, and so it started to get quoted. And then Paul Cabarly decided that Albuquerque might be a better place to spend a winter than Edmonton. So Calgary? Where is Paul? Anyway, someplace very cold.
I think Mike Grayson told me he's headed out to Calgary, if I remember.
I think that's right. I think it's Calgary. Yeah. So he came and did a winter sabbatical in my lab, and he's sitting in his office and he's studying my paper. And he said, Chris, I still don't see the difference between what I proposed and what you proposed for this. And he had a two-solution proposal. You know, up until well, you were in the linear range, you were having this process, and when you got into the competitive range, you were having this process. And so we had two separate things going on. And I said, Paul, it's a one-parameter fit. Oh. Now, this is, I take this very seriously because it's easy to say, Paul, what were you thinking? I mean, I put it in the paper. But I look back on that and I say, I didn't put it in the paper correctly. I didn't make enough of it in the paper. Somehow or another, somebody who really is super smart, knows exactly what they're talking about, is fascinated by the process itself, is studying the paper and misses it. Whose fault is that? So that's, I think, I keep getting reinforced that when you're breaking new ground, you really have an incredible teaching obligation going on if your message is going to get through, because people are stuck in thinking what they've been thinking. And they're going to keep thinking about what you're presenting in light of what they already know. Can't blame them.
Now when you have something that's an innovative idea or an innovative new theory, like what you were presenting, where people like Cabarle or McLafferty are stuck in kind of a different mindset, how do you deal with that in the sense that, you know, a couple minutes ago you said, you know, sometimes the things that you learned get in the way of kind of accepting something new.
Exactly. Yeah.
But when it came to electrospray, you were going back to something that you had learned in electricity and magnetism in graduate school.
Right.
So, you know, there's kind of this divide between sometimes you have to set aside things you know, and sometimes you have to really go back to some of the fundamentals of maybe what you know.
Yes. Yes. Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, I don't think you can be innovative without any, very, very often, unless it's quite accidental, without knowing what you're doing, without having some background. Although I have to say that I feel like I backed into mass spectrometry. I did not really understand mass spectrometry. I understood the analytical part of the process, so we understood what we needed to get from these processes. I understood, I learned and studied enough about quadrupoles to figure out how they were going to help solve the problem. But in terms of having a nice solid background in mass spectrometry, I really didn't. And I think that was hampering to some extent to not have that. I've had to develop that since. I've never taught a course in mass spectrometry. So I've written a book. On the other hand, I feel like when there's something very fundamental and it's real, and we can talk about this later when we're talking about what's real and what's theoretical. Facts are facts, explanations are explanations. And something like in a conductor, the surface is on the charge, the charge is on the surface, that's a fact. It's proven over and over and over again in all kinds of experiments. And so you have to accept that that's, if you get a result that doesn't make that doesn't take that into account, you have to think it over. Yeah. Well, then Cabarle became a believer, and started to publish himself along that line, and ran into trouble as well. An interesting byproduct of this, and I think it's something that's still to be done. I got to thinking about then, what are the characteristics? This is surface activity has to do with sort of having one foot in the electrolyte, right, and some arms waving around in the air, and so it's a partition. I got to thinking about chromatography as also being a partition, kind of an operation, and when we tried to use partition coefficients as measurements of surface activity, as it did not work. And I realized that the difference between surface activity and partition coefficient is that in the partition coefficient, the molecule has to go completely from one solvent to the other, not just hang there in the middle with 1 foot, you know, in the polar end and the other part in the nonpolar part. I thought that perhaps the sensitivity, the response factor that different analytes gave in electrospray ionization might be related to the retention time in reverse phase chromatography. And it is. And Nagicek tried that out, and it worked, and we published a paper on that. Okay, well, the other foot has not yet dropped. I'm not a chromatographer. But what I'm suggesting is that a lot of the partitioning that goes on in chromatography may not be complete adsorption into the stationary phase. And I really believe that that's very likely to be the case. That you get you have the nonpolar stationary phase, the polar mobile phase, and the nonpolar part of the molecule can stick up here. The polar part is in the polar phase. That part of the polar phase isn't moving because it's right, you know, from mechanics of flow. The flow is mostly in the middle and not at all. So it's like it's stuck. And it would be the same as if it had been totally absorbed, but I don't think that it needs to be. And I think that retention time and partition coefficient may not be as perfectly related as chromatographers think.
Interesting. That would be another probably hard to swallow paper for probably many chromatographers.
Well, I'll tell you another one that's very, very simple, and that's absolutely true. But yet you will not get chromatographers to agree to. In fact, there's two more. One is that in isocratic elution, line broadening is due to longitudinal diffusion. Okay. Because it's been on the column longer, the peak can spread out. It's not true. Very, very little of it is due to longitudinal diffusion. What it is due to is it's due to the fact that if you've got an analyte that's not well retained, what's its velocity through the column? What's its velocity past the detector? If you've got something that's fairly highly retained, what's its velocity through the column? What's its velocity through the detector? Same equation, exactly the same equation as you get if you postulate longitudinal diffusion. See, scientists have a little mindset. If they get an equation that matches the data, then that must be what it is. Mm-hmm. The fact that there might be other equations that also fit that same, that would produce that same result, that isn't going to be. So we still have Van Diemter plots and all of this stuff going on. Based on longitudinal diffusion. Now, Vicki McGuffin, I was convincing Vicki McGuffin of this at Michigan State, and she was looking at liquid chromatography, and she was using a spectroscopic probe to probe the band broadening on column before it came to the detector, and demonstrated that what I said was right. But it's still not accepted, and you still won't find it in the textbooks. and another thing that people don't accept still is Giddings and Davis Poisson distribution of peak overlap. Very few people accept that you've got that much overlap, that you've got hidden compounds and all of that sort of stuff, because they'll run the chromatogram, and they'll see a peak, Okay, and there's the total ion current. In the total ion current, they'll look there and look at the mass spectrum, and it's a nice clean spectrum. So what's the problem? Rarely is it a mixed spectrum. But the reason, of course, is that the components in the chromatographic sample have a dynamic range of 10 to the 5th or 6th. So you can have easily, way more often than not, your mixture is going to be made up of one prominent compound and a bunch of other things that wouldn't show. So I've argued with chromatographers over that for a while. But anyway, but we do get stuck. We get seriously stuck. And it takes, something like a bomb to get people to change their minds. We see that in all fields of science. And it's painful. Mm-hmm. And I think it's unfortunate, and that you were asking about that paper that I wrote on reuniting natural philosophy and scientific research. And if we were a little more open-minded about our explanations and realized that not only were they not unique, but they're probably wrong, we'd be looking for new ways to interpret our data rather than resisting them.
Now, while the electrospray research was going on, that's when you were, or had you already transitioned to New Mexico?
That all happened here. Yep.
Can you talk about coming? And obviously, you had been at Michigan State for quite a long time.
Yes.
And then you came out here.
That's right. Okay. Well, the chair sent me a formal letter saying you've been here 25 years. You're eligible to retire. And I have a little model on this. When Herb Lightman got a letter like that, he said fine and went to Gainesville. Right? And he was happy, adjunct and so on there for the rest of his active years.
With a much nicer winter.
With a much nicer winter than Champaign-Urbana. And before that, I had his name on the tip of my tongue, organic chemist, invented rubber, synthetic rubber. He was a prof at the University of Illinois, and when he got that letter, he went to Arizona. Marvel. Mm-hmm. What was his first name?
Carl,
Speed.
Carl, yeah.
Speed Marvel. So, also, I think they'd heard all my jokes and all my ideas about how things could be better. And by that time, families had dispersed, had remarried, and there really wasn't anything very strong holding BME in East Lansing. And so we realized, except our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so we realized that when we weren't working anymore, we were probably going to be someplace else. So whenever we traveled, we'd be thinking about where it might be nice to be. And so then weren't making very much progress on that, and he said, how about your student who's out there in Albuquerque? You said you could get a give a talk out there sometime, why don't we go look? And so I thought, well, yeah, and maybe I could investigate having a sabbatical and we could sort of check it out.
Mm-hmm.
So Tom Nimczyk was the name of my student, and he was a joint student with me and George LeRoy at Michigan State, and he came out here directly and was part of the faculty here. And so I kind of invited myself to come and give a talk and explore sabbatical possibilities. And we stayed at a nice little B&B in North Valley and for a week, and looked around and explored the area and wandered around through Old Town and up on the mountain and up the Turquoise Trail. And the last morning that we were going to be there, I remember it was a Friday, I woke up and I said, you know, it's really stupid to take a sabbatical here. We'll come. My wife's a psychoanalyst in private practice. She'd lose her practice. Then you have an obligation to go back to your home institution for a year after that at least. And so then she would have to try to reconstitute a practice. And then, and I've been on a sabbatical before, and I did not like what happened being at a distance from my graduate group. I remember things that went on that really did not work out well for me or the students. And so I thought, this is really silly. I've got grants. Why don't we just move here? It was the night before. Tom Nimczyk and Alan, I think his name in a moment, and I went out to dinner with our families, and I said, I've changed my mind. I don't want a sabbatical. I just want a job. It was really nervy. But it turns out they had just had a failed senior hire in analytical chemistry. Tom desperately wanted to take his sabbatical the next year and wasn't going to be able to do that if they didn't have enough people to cover the courses. And so, timing. Timing was everything. So anyway, it all worked out. So we just decided to move. And it was a really, really nice thing.
Yeah.
It really worked out well. I love the students here. I had a better time teaching undergraduate here than I ever had.
Huh.
Before.
Were you teaching graduate courses here as well?
Yeah. Okay. Graduate courses, not a graduate. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What made teaching the undergraduates here more exciting? What was it?
They had this naive idea that they were going to college to learn something. Not just to get a degree or pass a course, but to actually learn something. We figured it out. B understands this too from her psychoanalysis. There's a huge difference in terms of what people are willing to put into it. That depends on who's paying. So if the insurance company's paying, it's just something you go do, you know, fix me, doc. And if it's coming out of their pocket, they take more personal responsibility. The students here are largely older. A lot of them have families and jobs. They're taking classes part time. They're really, this is biting into their discretionary time and money, big time. And just one evidence of it is I'd have more students, and I have so many students in my office hours it wouldn't fit in my office. I had to get a separate room for.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Now, that's more people than I would see in a year at Michigan State.
Wow.
Each time. It was really wonderful. I enjoyed it, and the ethnic mix here is just incredible. The old Spanish families that have been here 100 years before Jamestown.
Huh.
You know, we just don't quite appreciate how what history existed here before it became part of the United States, and that's still here, and it's still very evident. And then there's the Native American groups as well, and it's just, it was rich, just a really rich experience. Yeah. And made good friends, had a lot of wonderful students to work with. It really didn't matter whether I was teaching quant or experimental or what.
Now, did you have graduate students that came with you?
I did have some. Had some that had already passed their prelims, so they graduated from Michigan State and went back and had their finals there, their orals. And then I had some that came with me, and their credits transferred, and they did their prelims and finals here. And then I got more students. And the interesting thing was that some of my very best students came here to work with me after I moved, even though clearly the University of New Mexico isn't department doesn't have the stature that Michigan State did. But really, some of my very, very best people that I've ever had worked with me here. So I've got quite a lot of nice work down here.
Yeah. And I would imagine slightly nicer winters.
Well, you know, I grew up in Minnesota. I didn't bother. The winters never bothered me. But the grayness did.
Okay.
Yeah, 330 gray days in Michigan, 330 sunny days. So.
It's a nice switch, I think.
Yeah. It was a nice switch. Well, electrospray work did come to be accepted. A number of people did some other fundamental work using spectroscopy and suspended drops and a number of other things that have verified the equilibrium partition theory concept. It's been adopted by by a number of people, and I think that it was a helpful move forward for the area. It's one of my most widely cited papers. And then Nadja Cech, CECH, was one of the principal students that I had working with me on that project. And so we ended up writing a chapter for the encyclopedia, and also we have a chapter in Richard Cole's new book on his second edition on electrospray and quality. So it kind of put us front and center into that field.
Now, did the electrospray ionization work, did it continue to be kind of thought experiments and theory, or was there kind of experimentation or?
Oh yeah, we had a lot of experimentation.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
And you mentioned that paper is, you know, one of your most widely cited papers.
Yes.
And do you have any thoughts as to, you know, why that paper, as to, you know, any other number of things you might have done?
I think it opened up a new way of thinking about things. And so when people are writing a paper that uses that concept, surface activity as being a driving factor in electrospray response, they're likely to cite that paper. Yeah.
Did you have any expectation at the time that it was going to be your most cited paper?
I didn't mean it was the most cited. Probably the MSNS paper is the most cited. But yeah, it was certainly one of the most. No, but it did occur to me afterwards that the most cited papers that I've had were the ones that I had the most difficulty getting published.
So really the stuff that was challenging kind of people's existing thought
yes.
process.
So how else did the research develop while you were here at New Mexico? I mean, in addition to the electro spray ionization work, what else were you guys working on?
I was working on trying to get MSMS information more efficiently. When your first mass analyzer and your second mass analyzer can each only pass one mass at a time, like in the triple quadrupole, then when you think about the entire data set that's available to you, you have intensity here, and you have first mass axis on here, and your second mass axis here. So you've got a two dimensions of parameter and a third dimension of intensity, right? That's available to you. And in a tandem quadrupole instrument, you can get one point at a time. The nice thing about the tandem quadrupole instrument, however, is that you can scan in any direction or any combination of directions you want to when you scan. All that entire data set is available to you scan by scan. But on the other hand, the time that would be required to collect the entire set would be prohibitive, generally, in terms of time and sample. And so people don't do that. Now if you combine the quadrupole with time-of-flight, time-of-flight's a batch analyzer, and so it gives you a complete spectrum every time it runs. So you can select your precursor mass and then run with time-of-flight. You can get the whole product mass spectrum at one time. So now you can do a whole slice through this at once, and you can scan the precursor ions and get the entire data set. People don't even do that very much. But it certainly is much more efficient. More efficient still than that would be is if you had a way to use batch analysis for both. And so we got interested in time of flight, tandem time of flight. And we got interested in doing that about exactly the same time as Bob Cotter did. And and we designed almost identical instruments. Instruments in which the flight path came here, went through a mirror, angled off through an interaction region, went into another mirror, and came to the detection of a Z configuration. But we wanted to do the fragmentation with photo dissociation. It just keeps coming around. but we thought that if we could focus the ions at the interaction point and focus the laser right there, that we could really get some pretty high efficiency for the fragmentation. In fact, we were able to do quite well. So we worked on that and built an instrument and published some results. But the collisional fragmentation was still more practical, and so then. So we weren't really competitive with Cotter's results, and also then Mark Vestals started to make a company to do this,
right.
And so the tandem time of flight took off from there. But that was one of the things that we were working on.
When did you start working on distance of flight mass spec?
Okay. So Graham invited me to come to Purdue and give a talk on ion mirrors. I don't even know why. And so I was thinking about ion mirrors. And I was thinking about the possibility of ions retaining as they got deflected into the mirror of maintaining their position as they came to the detector, sort of just like this. And so I imagined a time-of-flight instrument that had analysis of the ion mass in this mirror this way, but which in fact would retain the spatial information that the ions had coming in, so we could get mass information and spatial information. And the other thing that I was thinking about was that in if you fragmented ions, so here I am, I'm trying to solve this MSMS business still to get all that information at a time, and even Tuftoff wasn't really doing it. And I thought, I need to get all of this on a 2D detector. And so here's the problem. You have to create all the fragments right away. But then you have to have a means of telling which precursor each fragment came from. And that's the problem, right? I mean, you can make all the fragments right away, but then telling them, sorting them out according to their precursor is the thing that you end up having a problem with. So, so what happens when you fragment an ion? Well, the interesting thing is the fragments continue to have the same velocity that the precursor did, if you keep them out of fields afterwards. So so if you fragment the ions, the fragments are going to have the velocity. So now that's a clue. The fragment velocity tells you what the precursor mass was. Now, so then I realized that if we fragmented the ions, all of them, they would sort out according to their precursor's mass. So then if we put them in this time-of-flight mirror thing, that the precursor mass would the information would be in the position, the product mass would be in the time of flight. And we'd get it all. So I can see, so I've thought of this as a simultaneous MSMS machine, and I wrote a patent disclosure and presented the concept at an ASMS meeting in Montreal. It was in the process of writing the patent that I realized that hidden in that concept was a new kind of mass spectrometer called distance of flight. That, in fact, what I was doing was I was, if you just took those ions and accelerated them directly to a detector, you'd get mass separation by distance, not just a detector, but an array of detectors, right? And suddenly I realized this was a whole new kind of mass spectrometry, because the mass information is in which detector it hits, not in when it hits it. And you have a whole array of detectors to work with instead of trying to get all your information, and this is a huge amount of information we're talking about now, through one detector at the end of your flight path. The second thing I realized was that if I was going to, so now suddenly there's distance of flight mass spectrometry, and that's part of the patent. But then I realized that in order for this to work, I had to have a means of focusing ions at their respective flight distances. And this is totally different from focusing ions at the detector. Now, time of flight is a very simple thing. Ions start in the source, and you accelerate them, and if you give them all the same energy, they'll all have the same velocity, so they'll all arrive at the detector at the same time if they're the same mass, right? But in fact, they don't all start from the same place, and they don't have zero energy when you accelerate them. This way, some of them are going that way, different velocities, and so that's what leads to defocusing. You need a means of getting focusing. Time of flight was one of the very first methods of mass analysis that was ever invented, but it has lousy resolution unless you do these focusing things. So now, accelerating the ions to a constant energy and focusing them at a single detector was something that was that's now accomplished universally by using an ion mirror to refocus the ions. Getting all the isomass ions to hit the detector at the same time, having flown the same distance, is not the same as getting them all focused at the same time, having flown different distances. And so I realized that in order to really solve this problem correctly, I was going to have to learn how to focus ions in a distance of flight mass spectrometer. And I had a postdoc. He was working on an instrument that, now we had a grant from SciEx, and they gave us an old instrument, an old QTOF. It should have been perfect to do this, and he was mostly working on the hardware by which we could accomplish the separation and detection and so on. And I was mostly working on the means of focusing, how we were going to get ions to focus. I wrote LabVIEW or Excel programs in BASIC, Visual Basic, to try to figure out how we could possibly do this. And I probably spent a year, maybe more, trying different things. Just sitting at the computer and, does this work? Does that work? How about this shape of acceleration pulse and that and so on? And finally things started to click. And all this time I'm teaching myself things that I know about time of flight. It was really, and I was conscious of doing this. I thought, well, this doesn't apply anymore. We've got to forget this. And then another thing would come up that I realized I was assuming incorrectly. And then finally it clicked. And when it clicked, it was simple. And it was exactly the direct complement of the way that you do it for time of flight. It uses an ion mirror, but it uses a different means of acceleration. It's a means called constant momentum acceleration instead of constant energy acceleration. And time of flight, it turns out, focuses the spatial dispersion of the ions as they start, but doesn't focus their energies. It achieves the energy focus by just giving it one hell of a jolt to begin with, so that it tries to get everybody lined up at the same time. But the one thing that it doesn't do is that an ion that was moving first this way now gets re-accelerated this way. By the time it comes back to where it started, it now has the correct velocity. It's a little late. So that turnaround time is the principal source of defocus in time of flight mass spectrometers. When you use constant momentum acceleration, and I published this paper also in NanoChem, when you use constant momentum acceleration, all the ions get the same momentum. Turns out that now there is a time at which they will be spatially focused. Energy focused, actually, at the at their respective flight spaces. And at that time, you can drive them to a detector array and you've got a spectrum. And it's the exact complement. It focuses the energy dispersion, but not the spatial dispersion. Whatever spatial dispersion they had to start with, you end up with. Well, I think this has great potential for surface ionization techniques because you don't have any ion depth to start with. But you have a lot of energy dispersion in the in MALDI and other processes like that. So so I think that, that it has some good potential value in that direction. I was excited about that, to find that, because it was intellectually is probably the most challenging thing I've ever done, because it broke all kinds of thought barriers in the process of getting there. It's something no one else has done, and other people have looked at constant momentum acceleration before. It has the potential, I think, for really making array detection a good option in mass spectrometry. Now, array detection has several advantages. One is the one I've already mentioned. You've got a whole bunch of detectors going. Each one of these can be is there to just detect one mass of ion. So it can independently be accessed. It can independently be auto-ranging. So the potential for dynamic range in this is absolutely huge. There's no limit, basically, to the dynamic range one could accomplish with a ray detector mass spectrometry. So is that a problem? Do we need dynamic range? So I sent off we sent off a proposal. Now, by now, I'm collaborating with Gary Heath at Indiana University, because Gary and Bonner Denton developed the array detector. And that was what I needed, was an array detector. So, and by now I don't have a research group. I've retired, and my postdoc is gone, and and SCIEX has stopped funding. And so, so I start this collaboration with Gary, and he's got the detector. So that's why this seemed like a nice match, and it has been. Mm-hmm. It's been a very nice match. Mm-hmm. And so, but he's an elemental mass spectroscopist, and so his ion sources are glow discharge and ICP and things like that. So that's what we've been using. Mm-hmm. So it's actually we're doing some really neat things. We've now done energy focus at a time of flight detector. We call that Zumtopf, because it turns out that you can spatially focus a beam, accelerate it, and then even though you've introduced some energy components in the process of the focusing, those get canceled out by the constant momentum acceleration, and you can treat the time of flight detector as though it were just one element in your spatial detector, and get about a 5 or 10 times improvement in resolution at the time of flight detector, but just for a narrow mass of ions. So we call that Zumtopf, because you can take, and it turns out now for elemental mass spectrometry, this might be very good, because there are argon oxides and things like that that interfere with some of the metals, and they're only, you know, a few thousandths of a mass unit separate from the ones that you want, but you can zoom in on that and separate out those interferences. And so that's what they're working on right now, and I think it's pretty exciting.
Do you have to go to Indiana?
I Skype with the students and postdoc there, and research associate that's working on this every week.
Oh, wow.
I missed it this morning for you guys.
Oh, thank you. You said yesterday, you mentioned very briefly that you had a Skype collaboration with someone in Belgium.
Yes.
Just recently. Was that as part of this distance of flight work?
Indirectly.
Okay.
when we proposed to build this instrument, and Gary is seeking funds for this, we went to NIH for an instrumentation proposal, arguing to them that this dynamic range was advantage was going to be really, really important for complex mixture determination. So you've got your abundant components, your ubiquitin and things like that coming out here, but now how much at what point is your detection, when you get down to your detection limit, what are you missing?
Mm-hmm.
And can you get there by increased dynamic range? Well, one argument is that if the detection limit is of course, the signal that comes up over the background noise, what's the background noise? Well, the background noise is ions that are below the detection limit.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you could move the dynamic range, this would really help. And the proposal got very bad reviews. Some of them were from mass spectroscopists who said, we already have 10 to the 6th dynamic range, which is true, as long as you can change the integration time. And you can only do that for one mass, particular masses. But anyway, if you change the integration time, you can definitely get 10 to the 6th dynamic range. On the other hand, if you're using it as a chromatographic detector, you don't get to change the integration time because you're taking fractions of the chromatogram that are coming along like that. So that was not correct. And the chromatographers said that dynamic range wasn't the problem, it was interferences. Which is another way of saying we need more dynamic range, but they don't see it that way. So in any case, it didn't sell. And I realized it didn't sell because I didn't have a compelling argument. I couldn't say what was going on. So I started to look into complex mixtures. How complex are they? How many components are there in a complex mixture? What is their concentration distribution? If I knew what their concentration distribution is, then I'd know what was missing. So I started to look into the literature, and I read bunches and bunches and bunches of papers there are only a small set of the chromatographers that are working on this, but Joe Davis and some Europeans. That work on this sort of theory of chromatographic separation. So they kept referring to it as exponential. And I had heard this before. The lower you go in concentration, the more compounds there are going to be in this lower level, and it just goes up exponentially. And they kept referring to this one paper by Luke Nagels. And I got the pulled of the paper, of course, of Luke's, and read it, and he's done this for lipids, plant extract lipids, and painstakingly tried to decompose all the overlap peaks and stuff with a computer algorithm and so on, and came up with some data, and he says he tried to fit it to an exponential curve and wasn't very successful. But everybody quotes that paper when they say that it's exponential. Now, this is a really interesting twist, isn't it? I'm going to need to use it. Let's pause for a second.